Well, good morning, and thanks for coming out so early on the second last day of this conference. I must say it's quite a pleasure to be here talking to you about pharmaceutical system strengthening. As the session title, this session we're discussing health systems. And it's quite unusual or quite a privilege to be able to talk to other public health professionals about how pharmaceutical system strengthening can have an impact on public health. I remember I started attending APHA meetings when I was a pharmacy student, and most of the time I'd walk up and down the aisles with, I don't know, I couldn't understand anything. Everything was about surveillance and GIS mapping and networking and all those big epidemiology words. So it is really great to see that this year there were actually other sessions apart from this one that were talking about drug-related issues, medicine issues. Because frankly, all I remember the last time I was in San Diego was going to Tijuana. Anyway, the topic I'm going to talk about is really a very simple story about how you can strengthen a pharmaceutical service in a low resource settings, and in this case, in the provision of HIV/AIDS, and how as you strengthen that pharmaceutical service, you can result to significant impacts in terms of public health. So in this case, the story I'm going to tell you about is based on one district hospital, Port Reitz, I can never quite say it. And the reason we chose to talk to you about this hospital, because it was one of the first public sector sites that introduced ART treatment in Kenya. And also they've become a model for us and a learning site for more than 100 other sites in Kenya. Now, the majority of us tend to think of medicines more in a curative sense, but just consider that in a country like Kenya, the major health diseases of public health importance, HIV, AIDS, malaria, are treatable with drugs. Yeah? Do you or do you not need the drugs to manage the disease? Yeah, you do. You definitely do. And if you don't have the medicines, you're not going to be having a very big public health impact, right? So we are faced with diseases that are treatable, that require drugs, that have a huge public health impact. And secondly also, unfortunately, is that the pharmaceutical management systems are very weak. So we do need to strengthen them. And therefore, that's where the merge comes from in terms of clinical use of pharmaceutical care and its relationship at a public health level. I have no disclosures. Then just a quick overview. Kenya is located on the East African coast of Africa. So just close your eyes, East Africa, Somali, where the equator is, okay? And HIV prevalence rate, based on the last survey in 2007, unfortunately reported it was about 2 points up at 7.4% in comparison to a demographic health survey that was conducted in 2003. Now, we're still trying to find out exactly whether that was a survey effect or whether it was a true effect. So most of us probably think it is the true effect. And as you can see, there are quite regional differences in terms of the HIV prevalence across the country, from as high as 15.3% in the western coast of Kenya and going as low as 1% next to the Somali border. And I have lost my mouse by a pointer. Oh, there it is. Okay. So 1% there, 15.3% here, and quite a bit of wide variation. The facility I'm going to talk about is located in the coast province of Kenya, which has about the third highest rate of HIV prevalence. So my discussion today will very briefly highlight some of the pharmaceutical service issues that are of a public health importance and that are pertinent to this talk. And then I'll also describe to you how a simple intervention, in this case an electronic tool, was used to strengthen pharmaceutical management systems and how that can result to improved public health outcomes in terms of HIV/AIDS. MSH, Management Sciences for Health, specifically the Strengthening Pharmaceutical Systems program, started working with the Ministry of Health in Kenya, specifically the National AIDS and STI Control Program, about 7 years ago, to support them in implementing ART treatment in Kenya. Now, for us, that was quite something new. So you can imagine that you have a new disease that has come into the world. Nobody knew about it. And then a few years down the row, you have new medicines that you've never heard about, and you want to integrate this into the healthcare system. Now, when you talk about 7.4% of the population being HIV positive, that turns out to be about 2 million people. And if we use the strictest of criteria for starting these people on medicine, that's about 400,000 people that need to be placed on ART. So you need to put 400,000 people into the healthcare system that is already constrained. So there was need to clearly identify in a setting that had poor pharmaceutical services the type of things that would be needed, the type of interventions that would be needed to ensure that these services were streamlined in a smooth way into care. So with funding from USAID, this work began in 2001, and at that time, Coast Province still had the third highest prevalence of HIV, and morbidity in terms of hospital admissions was estimated to 30 to 40% of hospital admissions are related to HIV. So some of the issues we found are pertinent to this discussion, amongst other gaps in terms of pharmaceutical management systems, were closely related to how information was stored, particularly in the pharmacy. So as in other developing countries or low-resource countries, most of health records were paper-based, meaning you wrote on a tissue paper, you wrote in an exercise book, on the back of a cardboard box. Because most of the time, if you were supposed to write on some sort of national health record, that record was not available. So health facilities had to improvise and document something somewhere. However, even when they documented that, the documentation was poor. So you would find this exercise book or this little piece of tissue paper that told you on certain Saturday that this drug was received. And that was it. You know, how much, where it came from, you had no idea. So not only was it paper-based, there was poor record-keeping practices. And in pharmacy as well, there was absolutely no patient-centered record. So most of the records talked something about or indicated something about a medicine, but nothing about the type of patients who visited that pharmacy, how old they were, even their names. In fact, the only record that seemed to be there was what we call the dangerous drug record. And a dangerous drug record is the pethidines and the codeines. And it behooved you to complete that record, otherwise you were most likely the culprit using the medicine. So that was the only incentive to complete these records. Other issues we found was absence of counseling. Now, most of us have visited pharmacies here, yeah? CVS. What other names are there? Safeway, I've forgotten the names, Albertsons, Walgreens. And for each one of you, you know, the pharmacist, most of you want to get away as quickly as you can. But here, because of OBRA 90, the pharmacist wants to retain you to make sure they tell you something, yeah, about the medicine. But in Kenya, most of the situation was, oh, moja mara mbili, which in Swahili means take one three times a day, and you just go away. And that was it. And you'd receive this medication, and it hardly had a label on it. And then, of course, poor infrastructure. Now, unfortunately, this picture is not very clear, but it just shows some of the issues I was talking about. So you can see overcrowding. These are actually dispensing windows over here. And there's what looks like millions of patients waiting to be served. And this queue must be cleared before 6 p.m., and then also records, and most of the records here look like they're all drug-related. I don't know how many of you have worked in developing countries. This is what is called a stock card or a bean card. So you would write everything you want to know about the drugs in it. And most of the time it's blank. And then when it comes to dispensing, you have all these brown envelopes the medicines will be put in, and most likely it will not be labeled. So what were the implications for ART, meaning treatment of HIV/AIDS patients? One, it meant that it was unlikely that pharmacists would be able to participate in pharmaceutical care of patients. Meaning, in chronic care, the chronic care model advocates that one of the key things you need to have is clinical decision-making sort of information system. But that was absent in pharmacy. So the pharmacists had no idea what type of patients they had there. So it was not possible for them to participate in any meaningful inputs in terms of patient care. And you remember I alluded to the fact that a lot of our diseases are treatable with drugs. Therefore, it's important to have everybody participate in their care. Secondly, with the poor record-keeping practices, it also meant that it was going to be very difficult to estimate the quantities of ARVs needed for each facility. It appeared that it would be also difficult to be able to identify patients who did not pick up their medicines. And for chronic care diseases, this is important in terms of adherence. And we also saw that it was likely that as the number of patients increased, even the best paper-based system would eventually become cumbersome and tedious. So after a series of other interventions over a period of a year, of course, to strengthen other systems, we worked together with facility staff and the Ministry of Health at these three sites to design a simple computer-based tool, we felt, that would, one, assist the pharmacy staff to be able to track medicines consumption. That was our first interest, because the national program wanted the information now. They wanted to be able to know what the consumption trends were so that they could purchase the ARVs ahead of time. But we were also interested in this other issue of being able to provide the pharmacists with clinical information so that they could do pharmaceutical care. So we also created a basic system to enable them to record a little bit of patient information and medication history. It's a simple access-based tool that was targeted for use by anybody who was considered to be a dispenser. Predominantly here you talk about dispensers being pharmacists and pharmaceutical technologists. Well, in Kenya and most other countries, it could be anybody. Even the custodian you would find at one time dispensing medicines. So our interest is to make sure that at first, that as long as it was a semi-qualified person there, they would have the right information to be able to support patient care. So this is what the home screen of the tool looks like. And some of the key features is that it maintains a dispensing record for every patient, which means that you keep a history of all the medicines you've ever issued to the patient, the dose, the drug quantities, even the dispenser who issued it. You also have a stock record of all the medicines ever issued to the ever received in the facility. So anything that was received, which whoever the supplier was, and anything you might have issued to another facility. Inside the tool, in the report section, we also embedded a patient diary system that would enable the dispenser to give an appointment to a patient based on the length of time the prescription would cover. And then the dispenser would be able to quickly print out a report that would tell them at any particular day who did not return to pick up their medicines. And that would support adherence and tracking of patients. And then lastly, all kinds of reports to do with medicine consumption and to do with patient consumption. So how did we go about implementing the tool? We started in the three public health facilities in the Coast Province. And like I said, we'll only just tell you the story at this district hospital. It's currently a 160-bed hospital. At that time, it was only about 140. Started providing ART about 4 years ago today. And at the peak of the program, the hospital pharmacy was seeing about 60 new patients every month. That is in addition to all other, usual patients. You were getting 60 new, completely unknown patients coming into pharmacy. So implementation was pretty quick. We used funding to buy a computer, we installed the software, trained the pharmacy on staff, provided user manuals and other training guides for the software. And the technical assistance was limited to 2 visits at the time of training and then during installation. And the rest of the time it was on the phone from Nairobi. And remember, this is the coast province, about 300 miles away. From time to time, we would require the help of a pharmacist from a nearby facility. So as you can see, those are the current pharmacists at the facility. The lady on the right is a pharmacist in charge, and the other gentleman is actually a pharmaceutical technologist. So how did the pharmacy staff use this tool for pharmaceutical care? So just quickly, I think most of pharmaceutical care is a new terminology that we in pharmacy have been sort of flinging around for the last 10 years, sort of. And there are lots of definitions, but I'll just use this one described by Linda Strand. And it basically just talks about a practitioner taking a responsibility for a patient's drug-related needs, which will say, oh, well, yeah, physicians do that all the time. Yes, they do, because they have the clinical information, they prescribe the medicines, and they need to follow up in terms of what the patient needs are. The nurse does the same. But a pharmacist was typically not doing the same. And so this rationale of movement to start focusing on the patient rather than the drug, I think in the US and other countries, started in the 1960s, and it's only beginning to trickle down into other areas. Now, this definition assumes a couple of things: that you do have clinical information in front of you. So in our case, if we wanted the pharmacist to provide pharmaceutical care, we needed to provide them with clinical information. And that is what this dispensing tool, the software, did. This is the dispensing screen. So once you pick the patient's ID number, this is what shows up. We have obviously deleted the patient's name, so you can't identify them. But this is from a real database at the district hospital. So you're able to see a lot of demographic information about the patient, including issues such as cotrimoxazole, which are central to the ART program in Kenya that requires 100% coverage on cotrimoxazole. The dispenser can enter other issues to do with the concomitant illnesses, other drugs the patient is taking, and the white part of the screen tells you everything that you've dispensed to the patient, including the user. So what were they able to do? As of September 30th, last month actually, they had populated every single patient who had received ARVs at the facility. So when the tool was dispensed, it was installed a year after the ART program started. So the health staff went and pharmacy staff went and picked up all the data from previous manual tools and populated it. And as you can see, the majority of patients were adult females. They've also been able to maintain clinical information for a significant portion of those patients getting ART. In terms of concomitant illness, for close to 45% of the patients, and in terms of other drugs the patients are taking, which has an impact on how they're using the ART, for about 55% of patients. That little graph over there just shows some of the documented types of illnesses in the dispensing tool. These are aggregate numbers. So TB alone is a significant portion. Miscellaneous had things like diarrhea, rash, and what have you. The pharmacy staff also began documenting the interventions that they did and that resulted to a treatment change. And these are some of the interventions, meaning that the pharmacist would look at that screen, would identify something that needed to be changed, and recommend that the physician change it. So issues to do with weight change. These were the days when we used to use a stavudine-based regimen, where you would change from a 30 to a 40 milligram dose. So that was the most popular one. But there were other pretty nice interventions to see the pharmacist also being able to participate in. The pharmacists have also been able to track patients with regimen change. This is also important at the individual patient level to be able to determine subsequent regimens that you use. And also for the program as a whole to be able to understand whether or not they are complying to national treatment guidelines. So as of last month, of all the active patients, of all patients who are actively on treatment, 13% had had a regimen change. Now, that's not a large number, so don't be alarmed, because none of those were to second-line treatment. Most of them were switches to from a first line to another first line. So the tool is able to pick up all these differences. But additionally also is that they were able to document the reason for regimen change, which is a much more amazing feat, shall we say, for almost 90% of those who had a regimen change. And these are sort of some of the examples of the different reasons for regimen change. Most of them related either to an adverse drug reaction over here or other disease. Okay. Lastly, they were also able to identify patients who failed to pick up medications. This is hard to see, but this list, the pharmacist can print out, and they'll have a list of everybody who did not pick up the medications, and they'll hand this to a healthcare worker for follow-up to bring the patient back into care. So how did this result to public health benefits for the ART program? One, we've seen that they've managed to retain about 81% retention rate. That is not stellar performance, but it compares to the national average. They've been able to support the pharmacy continue to adhere to national treatment guidelines. They've been able to monitor adverse drug reactions and track them. And this is of importance because it also informs at the national level the type of treatment guidelines that you can use. And they've also been able to get rapid access to information to assist the facility to be able to estimate the quantities of medicines that they need. This just to further stress that 90% of the patients are on first-line regimens. And so finally, what have we learned using this simple tool? Actually, we did not estimate how quickly the tool would be scaled up to other countries. And it sort of spread by the grapevine, because we have almost 120 facilities in Kenya using it now, and another 40 to 50 in Uganda, Nigeria, and I think Tanzania. And what we did see that it seems it's possible to implement an electronic, a simple electronic tool in a resource-limited setting, and that the availability of this tool encouraged pharmacists and pharmaceutical technologists and other types of cadres to participate in providing pharmaceutical care. It enhanced the visibility of the pharmacy in terms of the ART program, and it also made it possible to always have information for quantifying your ARV needs. Our only recommendations based on other experiences also is that these solutions need to be simple, because facilities might not have the capacity to support the high-end IT solutions. But they need to be explored a little more and perhaps extended to other chronic care diseases, because they may yield significant benefits. And so thank you very much. We wish to acknowledge all those participants. And ART does work.
Thank you, Josephine. We're actually at the end of the time frame, I'm afraid. Yeah? For those of you who didn't see everything, we started with Anno talking about the use of contradictions, basically, between growth economically, particularly in the pharmaceutical industry, growth and profits in public health goals, and how physician prescribing data is being used to manipulate prescribers. And it's not unique to the United States, by the way. It is happening in Latin America. I just reviewed a book called Global Pharmaceuticals that covers some of that. Laura's presentation, passionate presentation on civil society and health as a human right, Frank on key issue in sub-Saharan Africa, brain drain, and Josephine's that she's just completed on ARTs and a new system for tracking things, pharmacy care in Kenya. The time is up, but if anyone wants to stay and talk a little bit, I'm happy to stay. I don't know about the panelists. Are there pressing questions? We'll take the one in the red tie first, yes. I think this is probably Frank.
And this question goes to Frank. From Ghana, Frank is also from Ghana. And I like the presentation, but there's one issue related to brain drain, and I would like Frank to address it. A friend of mine suggested that in order to maintain health care, especially doctors, for example,
Is this a related question? Because I think is your question related?
Yeah.
You also have a related question?
Not necessarily related, but also going to
Frank.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My name is Benjamin Mafo, and I come from Ghana. I'm currently undertaking a 1-year country fellowship course in the United States. Back in Ghana, I was the director of health services, and then Frank has been my boss for so many years. In fact, he's quite humble. I admire his humility when he said his CV was very, very small. He has a very rich.
That was a summary of the CV. It wasn't the CV.
Yes, okay. Well, as the director of health services, I've been worried about not about the external brain drain. Health staff leaving Ghana to go to the United States, Germany, or whatever. No, but I'm very worried about the internal brain drain, what you mentioned. It's about community-based and health planning services, the CHIPS concepts, which for me is the basis for primary health care. Now, back in Ghana, it's becoming very difficult to have an established CHIPS because the community health nurse, who is the core health personnel for the formation of the CHIPS in each district, when she graduates from school, after 3 years, You get her into the CHIPS program, and after 3 years she leaves, enters the RF course, and she moves elsewhere. So it becomes very difficult to have an established CHIPS back in Ghana. The nurses who are helping the CHIPS concept are now nurses who are barely, let's say about 15 years of age, 55 years. And it's a problem. Many of these young nurses are not staying to help us run the CHIPS, which is the basis the basis for the primary health care in the country. And I'm wondering how we are going to solve it because maybe we need to change the rules pertaining to moving from community health nursing to registered nursing or whatever it is. Because as of now, they are asked to only be community health nurse only for 3 years that they can move anywhere. And that's what most of them, they are using community health nurse as a stepping stone, like Frank said, to move elsewhere. And we cannot, it's becoming very difficult to manage to run the CHIPS in Ghana. So I hope you'll be able to respond to this.
Okay, we don't want the questions to get longer than his CV. So he's got three here.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the question. For most of you who are pushed to go, maybe I can take some of my colleagues' questions one-on-one when we leave the session. But briefly, for the contract, again, we are working in a third world developing country. Our services that we are providing are based on government services. Now, there are rules of engagement within that context. Government, as you said, government gives you the education. Government produces, gives you all the training. And then government employs you. And government expects you to deliver the service. Yeah, we are in a world, new world where individual rights also come into play. So that individual right person, individual says that I want to go to the States. You can't stop that person. Okay? One of the arguments that we are putting up is that do we need to add value to the basic education that government gives? If we need to add value, then we will have to find a way of retaining it. But if we don't add the value, then you are free to go. Okay? And within that context, yes, we can bond people to stay and provide services. Doctors, per se, are the most difficult ones. As you said, there are various strategies that we are using, trying to use to retain them. Contract on that basis is not yet there, but employment and more incentive and more incentives for them to stay have been the bane of the strategies for us. We've talked about contracting, giving contract to doctors so that the ripple of increasing the salary does not go to other cadres like engineers and food. So, yes, this is something that we've been thinking about within the governmental services. But to tell you the truth is, when you run a government, it's very difficult for some of these issues. I agree with you totally. When you give education to somebody, you want that person to pay back. But in the modern world, everybody has his own rights, and like the Americans, they will start marching everybody. Sorry. Now, on chips, I think I want to take it on with you one-on-one, because I will refrain from talking about chips now.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you for tonight's presentation on Kenya. One question I have is more of a system issue. I noticed that you had a very good database system that you're using, and I wondered if that database system has the capacity to include, let's say, cell phone numbers. And the reason I'm asking that question is I saw the opportunity of being able to integrate cell phone, which is the diffusion of cell phones in Africa. One of the most exciting areas that you can reach even grandparents with cell phone. And the question you raised about people who are not taking their medication or something, I was thinking with a cell phone, even if you created a way of educating people on how many times to take their medication or reminding them when to pick up their next medication, a text message can reach a very, very rural place in that area. And it seems like the system is set up in such a way that integrating text messaging system may be something. So I just wanted to know if
yeah. Yes, we are still at the baby steps, one at a time, you know, beginning even with the issue of trying to identify what are the IT skills in healthcare providers. We've been very lucky because in terms of pharmacy, the type of healthcare providers we are seeing are younger people who somewhere along the line got IT skills. Adherence is a big issue in Kenya. And it's an issue of quality of care, and actually that is sort of like the next level that we're going to. The dispensing tool just has a free text format that allows you to put the contact tracing information. But until we have connectivity at facility level, that you can push that button at facility level and it does the SMS, that will not be feasible. But that has more to do with facility infrastructure constraints. Remember, these are public health health sites But in the private health facilities, now I recall one or two, what they actually do is that they do just use their own mobile phones to call.
And yeah.
Yes.
The big companies, like Safaricom.
Yes, you're right. There's already a pilot project that's going to be launched in November, and I believe it's with RTI, and I think I saw RTI presenting, where they have worked with Telkom and Quadcom to put in connectivity at facility level so that those reports are not only sent at the push of the button to the national level, issues to do with adherence, but that's feasible.
Any other questions, or shall I release you all? Thank you very much.
Do you mind if I get in here?
No, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Thank you.
So I've got